Session number 23442, Rule 5.
And of course there was great hilarity with all concerned, but it didn't last for very long because we had orders to move down to Luneburg Heath, where the peace documents were to be signed. And we took over an area to the east of Luneburg, and our front line was the River Elbe, and the other side were the Russians. And so we spent a week or two there, where we got ourselves cleaned up and re-equipped, and went to the opera house at Hamburg, and there were various things laid on for us. But we had commandeered some boats on the Elbe, and this had happened on several places. But one of our people on a boat that broke down went over to the Russian side, and they got out of the boat and were immediately arrested by the Russians, and we didn't get them back after we'd left the area. And so the orders were never step out. And indeed I had an incident myself when we were in the boat with three of my lads, and we broke down. And we were stranded on the other side of the Elbe, on the Russian side. And the Russians came down. And we told them in best we could to stop it. And so I hailed a lot of barges on the with cargo up and down the Elbe, you know, the big German things. And I hailed one of those coming down. And they stopped, and they took us in tow and towed us to the other side. So we were lucky; we got away with it. And then we were eventually posted for the remainder of the time in Germany to a place called Goslar, which is a resort in the Harz Mountains. We had battalion headquarters in Millionaires Row. Signal platoon had a big house, and I was able to get the whole of my platoon, which wasn't at full strength, we never were, but probably 25 of us all in one house, which was very good. And periods of training and sport, and the sergeant's mess had a German cook, which we retained. We used to get parties out shooting wild boar, and we had some wonderful meals of venison, and it was quite a pleasant time. But then I was thinking of civilian life, and the army set up a course for people who'd had their education disturbed, mainly designed for the people who'd got up to their A levels, then called up and wanted to go back to university. But they hadn't got the university. They probably hadn't got their A-levels. Or it wasn't A-levels in those days. It was called matriculation. So they laid on a 3-month crash course to get this matriculation. It was called the Forces Preliminary Exam, but it was matriculation level. I applied for this, even though I hadn't got to the educational level of the others. There was some discussion on it, but my CO was very supportive. And I was able to go on this 3-month course. And we went to, we got a part of Göttingen University, which is in the Harz Mountains. And I did this 3-year crash course, this 3-month crash course, and passed. So that when I returned to civilian life, when I finished the course, I was due to for demob in 3 or 4 weeks, and I'd married during the war. I obviously couldn't afford to go to university, but it did give me the basis to study for professional exams, which I did part-time.
Which profession?
Part-time. It was the Institute of Personnel Management. So I went into... I went back to my job as a baker's roundsman because that gave me time to study. In the week, we used to start early but finish about 3:30 in the afternoon. So I had time to study. And I went to the local technical college and commercial college. And it was a 5-year part-time course. And I took that and got my professional qualifications.
What was the nature of this course at Göttingen University?
That was... 5 subjects, maths, English, and no, just an academic course. Maths, English, general knowledge, which was a funny one, but that was easy for, you know, it was easy. Well, yeah, because we'd had a lot of experience of life and you learn things. And I took as the optional subjects geography and I forget what the other one was. But matriculation included, you had to have a language with matriculation pre-war. The forces prelim eliminated that. You didn't have to take a language. If I'd had to take a language, I wouldn't have had a chance of doing it, of course. But it was a straight academic course, and it was done by the Army Educational Corps. But the instructors were very good. They were university. The one was, I don't think he was a professor, but he taught at university. And it was a cram course. We worked hard, but it managed to give me a start in civilian life, which I wouldn't have had without it. I mean, I couldn't have got the jobs that I had without my professional qualifications. And so that was the end of my war. I was demobbed in April 45. Number 27 group, I think, was they demobbed you by group, and I had a month's leave and then went back to work.
Was England much changed when you got back to it because of the war?
Yes, in some ways. As far as my job was concerned, there wasn't much change. I went back to the job that I was doing before I was demobbed. A lot of the older people were still there, and it wasn't very much different, except for shortages. And indeed, we had bread rationing, which was a hell of a bind, because you had to have these BUs, as they were called, bread units. And you had to take those as well as the money for everything that you were selling. And it was a very, you know, the shops, very little in the shops. Clothing, you had to have coupons to get clothing and coupons to get furniture. I managed to get the deposit on a house. My wife had continued working during the war and had put her money aside, and with my demob money we were able to get a deposit and took out a mortgage and got my first house. But I was trying to get, I knew I wanted to get into personnel management, but I had no office experience, I had nothing to offer, and I eventually got an interview with a company called Lucas, who at that time were a major company, making everything from lamps and things for the motor trade to a whole wide range of things. And I managed to get on their graduate trainee course. I wasn't a graduate, but I must have sold myself. And so I took this 1 year graduate training course. And that was a trainee's salary of £6 a week. On my bakery job, I was knocking up £10 or £11 a week. So I had a big cutback in income. My wife went back to work part-time, and I'd got a mortgage, no furniture. I didn't have carpet on my stairs for over a year. Could only furnish one bedroom and one living room, and gradually built up from there. So it was very difficult, very austere. But it gradually improved over the years.
Can you tell me how you got your MM, please?
Well, it's difficult. I was recommended several times. It's a bit of a lottery, getting medals. And the citation refers to my working under heavy fire and keeping the battalion's communications going and leadership and all that kerfuffle. It was a good write-up, but no specific incident. There are previous incidents that I've been recommended for. In the end, I was recommended for the Croix de Guerre in Normandy. There were allocation two to each battalion, and I was one that was recommended. And then at the last minute, they reduced the allocation, so I didn't get mine. The other bloke who'd attacked a machine gun nest, obviously. So I didn't get it then. I got mentioned in dispatches. I got a commander's certificate of whatever. And they're all results of being recommended. For the military medal. So there isn't a particular case.
What were the other cases where you were recommended earlier?
Well, actually in the Reichswald Forest when we lost a company. It was all heavily wooded area. We no communications. We couldn't contact them at all, and I fortunately have a very good sense of direction, and it saved my life several times. And so I went out with on my own with a salt cable. They had a little, very thin wire, a salt cable, to find this company. And which I did, and told the company to withdraw because they were exposed, and that was one specific occasion. I don't know, there are a couple of occasions in Normandy that I can't particularly recall, but the unfortunate thing with decorations is that so many people who deserve them don't get them. I mean, a number of my lads were worthy of decorations, but don't get them. Didn't get them. And then there are other people. I mean, I think as far as I was concerned, one of the other influences was that it was a decoration for the signal platoon. And that's what I looked upon it as a decoration. Okay, I was leading them, but couldn't have done it without all those lads there.
How do you feel now about having served with the Worcesters during the Second World War?
Very happy about it. I sometimes think, well, what would have happened if the war hadn't come along? Where would my career have gone? I really don't know. In the 30s, you were always looking for a safe job, and I thought, well, civil service, that sounds all right to get a pension and a job for life. That's where I ought to go, but I'm so glad I didn't, because I would have been a misfit in civil service.
Why?
Well, I suppose that my experience with civil servants, and these have been mainly from tax people, employment, business organisations, are that what I call a delegation upwards. They tend to say, well, I can do that, that's mine, I'm all right. But they can't get out of that box. Someone else has to go. And I got so frustrated many times, because you can't get at the man. You can't sit down and say, look, let's settle it. And you can't get an answer to settle it. You can if you get the right man high enough up, but you can't get at them. And there's an attitude. When the you probably remember that during the, I suppose it was during Thatcher's time, when they set up ACAS, which is the conciliation
service.
Yeah. Well, I helped with advice on setting it up. But I also helped with the training of the people who were coming into it. And the problem is with the civil service, they were setting up a new unit. It has to be advertised in the civil service. The obvious people who would be interested are the Ministry of Labour people and whatnot. And they're mainly clerks and not managers. And coming into ACAS, they had to be on their own in front with an employer and a union trying to bring them together. It's not an easy job. So I worked with a senior civil servant on it, and in developing the training program, I did a session on the private sector, which at that time was a dirty word. You know, all the private sector is make the profits and take them out. And so I used to do this session, which was an hour and a half, and they were a group of people who were, you know, mainly clerks, little or no management experience. And I used to try and stay overnight so that I could, you know, get to know them a bit better. But they used to say, oh, we're looking forward to this one with the private sector. We are now, you know, all you do is make money. I say, yes, that's right. And so I had a wonderful time, really, because I used to explain the organisation of a company and, you know, what happened to profits and everything else. You know, always be somebody saying, how about ICI's profits, all that money, you know, and that sort of approach. And I'd say, well, who pays your salary? The government. Where's the government get the money from? Well, you know, taxes that you pay and I pay, and the companies pay a lot of it. And supposing there wasn't a private industry, can you tell me a nationalised industry that's made a profit? And, you know, I've made it jocular, but it's a message that had to be got over, because if these people had got in front of a company industrial relations manager and a top union official, which is the level at which they're brought in, and really they had to do a lot of weeding out, because they soon found that when they gave them the job and put them in front, they were absolutely lost. But my impression, and it's generalising, my impression of civil servants, and I'm talking about mainly the clerical, the level at which most people deal, is that they know their own jobs generally very well, but they know the tram, they're in tram lines, and they know the limits. And when it gets to that, they say, well, you know, it goes up to, and you go to the next level, and they've got their limits. And you can take ages and ages trying to get a decision. Whereas in industry, it's not like that. The problem's there, you make the decision, you go ahead and do it. And I found a lot of frustration with civil servants. It's the same as education. We had a factory in Banbury, 2,000 people. 2,000 people, and my employment people came to me to say that they were having difficulty in recruiting qualified clerical people straight from school, and said that their educational level didn't meet the standard that we needed. So I discussed it, that we'd probably have to do some training of our own when they came, but I said I'd like to see it for myself, so will you set up two or three interviews for me to do? And I was quite frankly, when I did these interviews, I was quite staggered, because I'd asked them simple, what I took to be simple, straightforward questions as to what's a decimal point. They knew what a decimal point was, it's that dot in the middle. But when you wanted to know what does it do, what's its function, they really didn't understand it. And the other question I just asked now, percentages. What do you understand when I say percent? Quite deliberately, percent. Not one of them could tell me. They didn't know that it means each hundred or what have you. And I found that somehow or other, the teaching wasn't up to the standard that we needed.
Which years are we talking about now?
Oh, these are 16-year-olds.
No, which year? 1980, 1990?
Oh, I'm talking about 1970s. I talked it over with the head. I had a good relationship with him. As a result of that, I looked a little bit further and said, well, what do you do with your careers advisors? And he said, well, you better go and talk to him. So I arranged to talk to the careers advisor, and I said, now, you know, what are the sort of things you advise people to go in? And I found that they were very limited. The boys were either told to go to an apprenticeship, to get a good clerical job, civil service or teaching, there was nothing at all about industry didn't come into it, and girls were told be a secretary, be a nurse, or be a teacher. And I was concerned about this, and I said to the head, look, your careers advisor ought to learn a little bit about industry. I'm prepared to take him for a week. I'll pay him, and I'll give him a go round the organisation, so that he's got some idea of it. And so it was arranged during the summer vacation that he came and stayed a week with me, and he was quite staggered. He said, I didn't realise there were so many interesting jobs in industry. And following on from this, then I did a little bit of training with the careers advisors, which helped to broaden it. But you can't really blame the careers advisors. They say, well, you're a careers advisor, you know. And they're not given much help. And they have to find out a lot of things for themselves. So I found that a great weakness, and quite frankly, we had to set up our own training scheme to help with the basic education. The other thing, of course, was spelling. And these days, with computers, I don't know, in 20 years' time, nobody will be able to spell. It'll all be phonetics. I found that there were frustrations in this, but life in industry was very challenging, very exciting. I worked all my career in personnel management with two different American companies. There's a lot said about American companies. They are hire and fire. In some cases that is justified, but certainly the company that I worked for the major time weren't hire and fire at all, but you had to be able to do the job, and as far as management were concerned, you weren't criticised. You were encouraged to make mistakes. That's probably not quite right, but you were never prevented from making mistakes, because if you make a mistake, you should learn from it, and if you learn from it, you're a better manager for that, as long as you don't make too many mistakes. And we used to say that if a senior manager is right 7 times out of 10, he's a good manager. So he's going to make 3 mistakes out of 10, but that's life. Learn from them and do better. And the other thing, as far as employers were concerned, we started an appraisal system in 1952.
Jim Norton, Real Six. You were saying that you started
it. We started it in 1952, and a lot of discussion when it went in. We insisted that it went in from the top, and we took time in training right from the top down below. And so, first of all, we set up a seminar for the directors, and the directors went through this course of appraisal. We got an outside consultant in to help, and they did the appraisals of their people, and these were criticised, and we got the views from all the senior management on it, and eventually down through the organisation, but we took 4 years, and that wasn't onto the shop floor. That was only in the office side of the business. But we laid down a principle which has since been adopted by the government through ACAS, that if someone is not up to standard, the first thing you've got to do is tell them, Talk to them about it. How can you help? That's your job as a manager. And then make clear what standards they've got to make and set them deadlines and review it. And if they don't come up to the standard, then you give them a warning in writing to say, look, this isn't good enough, you're not making the standard. And this is what we're going to do to help you to do it. And then, if that doesn't work, then you give them a final warning in writing. And at the end of that, you leave a period of at least a month at which you will review, and you will either put them into a different job,